The second talk is, of course, about a topic that has attracted lots of attention in recent years, namely topological insulators. And Lorenz has been making a major breakthrough experimentally on this, so I took the opportunity for him to give us some sort of overview of where the field is going.
Okay. Yeah, this is the overview of the work we do on topological insulators. I see one person who has heard most of this, I think, but does everybody here know what a topological insulator is? Do I take it as a yes? Okay, good. So, this is kind of a general talk, but I talk about topological insulators from the Merck-Tellery perspective because that's the one that we have most fun with, which and it's still it's the only one that shows nice transport data. So part of this talk is about the spin Hall effect discovery and how it relates to the band structure of mercury telluride. Another part of this talk is on three-dimensional topological insulators, which in this case is strained mercury telluride epi layers, which are pretty thick so that they are really bulk-like. They show Dirac surface state and you can make Josephson junctions from them. And of course, the hope is that you will see some Majorana physics in the Josephson junction. Well, I'll show you where we are. I won't be talking about the quantum anomalous Hall effects. I guess we will not have time. So the material system that we use is mercury telluride, which is shown here in a plot of all the type of zinc blender materials. It's a very odd zinc blender material in that, well, A, it has a very large lattice constant, and B, it has a very small gap. One reason to show this plot is to show you what kind of substrate you could use to grow this material. And you see that actually, if you want to grow epi layers of mercury telluride, cadmium telluride is a good candidate. What you used to be able to get commercially is cadmium zinc telluride, which is lattice matched to Merck telluride. The reason that you can get that stuff commercially is, of course, that Merck telluride is a venerable semiconductor material. If you add a bit of cadmium, you can really scan the whole infrared range, and that's what people do. They make detectors out of them, night vision apparatus, and so that's why there's a whole industry going on here, and you have these substrates. The band structure of Merck telluride is where all the action is. It took a long time for all these early people to really figure out or to converge on an idea of the band structure. So what you have here is what was calculated in 72 and which is still correct. This is a tight binding calculation. And the big thing of this calculation, of course, is that, well, it's a zinc blender material, so you have a gamma 6 and a gamma 8 and a gamma 7 band, and the gamma 8 is a doublet, and that you have in all zinc blender materials. But the strange thing here is that the gamma 6, which usually is the conduction band in zinc blender material, and it comes from the lowest empty s orbital of your metal, actually has a energy here which is lower than the gamma 8, which you probably know as the light hole heavy hole doublet in zinc blender. The reason is that the S level here is on a mercury atom, and mercury is very, very heavy, and that means you get a simple relativistic velocity correction, a Darwin correction to the absolute energy, and that lowers the gamma 6 energy to below the gamma 8. So this gives you a inverted band structure that you can actually translate into a negative band gap, if you like. And that's, of course, where all the action is, because now we know that a topological insulator is a material where you have an odd-even inversion at a odd number of high symmetry points in the Brillouin zone. And one is odd, and I have an SP inversion here, So this material, in principle, is a topological insulator according to all the rules that, that have been developed. So that's a good thing. But it's not that good a thing, because if you count states in this undoped material, you will see that the Fermi level here is the gamma 8 doublet. And that means that Merck telluride by itself is perhaps a topological material, but it's a topological semi-metal and not a topological insulator. So you will see these surface states, perhaps in ARPES, but you cannot do transport through them because it's a semi-metal. So to make this material suitable as a transport object, what you will have to do is open up a gap in this gamma 8 doublet. Well, how to do that is pretty well known in the semiconductor world. What you do is you lower the zinc blender symmetry to something lower. And there's two more or less straightforward ways to do it. One is to grow a quantum well, and in this case we can combine mercury telluride with barriers of mercury cadmium telluride. This gives you what we now know as a two-dimensional topological insulator. It's a very thin system, of course. If you want to have a thicker three-dimensional topological insulator, what you can do is you grow the material on a substrate with a different lattice constant. And you try to do so coherently, meaning that the in-plane lattice constants of your epi layer are the same of your substrate. Well, the vertical one has to go down then, so you have lowered the symmetry of your material. And I'll show later on, you can do that also here when you grow Merck telluride on a pure cadmium telluride substrate. Okay, so first the quantum wells. Here is the situation. If you have a wide quantum well, because, well, Merck telluride is inverted, so here's the gamma 8 and here's the gamma 6. Because mercury cadmium telluride is already non-inverted, you get this overlapping type of quantum well, where the state that comes from gamma 8, which is called an E state, is still higher in energy here than the state that comes from gamma 6, the E state is still lower in energy than the state that comes from gamma 8, is called an H state here. So a wide quantum well is still inverted. And you see the state now is labeled H for heavy hole. You will also have a light hole state now. That creating this lower symmetry basically splits up the gamma 8 into a height, to a heavy and a light hole. Now, if you squeeze down your quantum well, you add confinement energy. And the confinement energy will push down this H state and push up this E state. So for something like 63 angstroms, they overlap. It's a crossing, not an anti-crossing. And then for narrow quantum wells, you have the E state above the H state, and you have a normal band structure. So you can really, in your quantum wells, tune your system from being topologically non-trivial to topological trivial. These are the quantum wells we use. Perhaps I shouldn't say too much about them. An issue with this material system is the lithography. You have to grow it at low temperatures, otherwise your mercury starts evaporating. That means that all your lithography, you also have to do it at low temperatures, which means you have to develop new processes. And a very nasty thing is that two sixes don't make nice Schottkys, so you cannot put your gate directly on top of your material. You have to work with a gate insulator, which again you have to deposit at low temperatures, which make them leaky and not sticking and whatever. So this is what we often use. We're always trying other materials, but yeah, so now we usually make 30 nanometers of this layer and that seems to stick. We can dope, we can not dope, and we play with this. One nice property of Merck telluride is, at least if you do MBE growth, you cannot dope it. There's nothing that can really electrically dope it. It might just be the surface state, actually. We can speculate about that. So if you want to dope your quantum well, you have to do modulation doping from the barriers, which you can do if you dope them with iodine. But typically for TI studies, we don't want to dope because you want to have the Fermi level as close as possible to the gap. Okay, here's a K dot P calculation done in our group something like 10 or a bit more years ago. So you can readily build a K dot P model for these layers. And actually, you see these Pankratov surface states in your K dot P model. Very interesting. What it also shows here is the confinement levels as a function of thickness of your quantum well. So here are these, all these eights, the heavy hole states going down with decreasing well width. Here's a light hole state. You really see there's a pretty big heavy light hole splitting already. And here's this E state that goes up with energy with increasing well width. And you have the crossing point here. There are some other things that are interesting. What you see here is the energy scale of all these levels. And you see how the gap is between E and H here. And so this is the gap in the system. The gap is of the order of 10 to 20 millivolts. So these quantum wells are extremely narrow gap semiconductors. And that means that actually in your K.P expansion for your dispersion, the linear term starts to dominate. What has been known, and this is actually just started with Bastar in the 80s and perhaps even earlier, these guys all have a pretty much Dirac system like dispersion. And so you can use them very nicely as model Dirac systems. So this we knew. What we did not know was really that these inverted Dirac systems that we have actually are topological insulators. And that emerged after I had met Soo-Cheng Tseng at a meeting somewhere in Korea, and we started talking about a previous graph. I sent him a thesis describing this work, and he came back with this paper where they developed this BHZ Hamiltonian that actually is a direct map of our K.P Hamiltonian to the low energy regime. And so he showed that you have Dirac behavior in these systems, but again, that was not really a surprise. The important point was that he showed that actually these inverted Dirac systems are topological insulators and show the quantum spin Hall effect. Okay, the quantum spin Hall effect, I think in this audience I probably can.
No, I think it is good that you review this.
Yes, I should show this? Okay. So the quantum spin Hall effect is an attempt to generalize the quantum Hall effect. And the quantum Hall effect you can understand as an extension to our concept of what an insulator is. And let's first begin with classical physics, where you have a conduction band, which is empty, a valence band, which is full, and a gap. And this is a material in which all electrons are bound to the atom cores, and nothing's happening. So this is boring for a transport physicist. And these were all the insulators we knew until 1981. And then in 1981, all of a sudden, there was something called the quantum Hall effect. And now there's many ways to look at a quantum Hall effect, but it's also an insulator, but then of a very special kind. And because the quantum Hall effect, you know, occurs in a two-dimensional electron system where you have a perpendicular magnetic field. And that means that in the bulk of the sample, all the electrons see this perpendicular magnetic field and start to rotate around the field in a very nice fashion. But that means the magnetic field localizes them. So the bulk of the material is an insulator. However, if you have an electron which is located close to the edge of the sample, and this is the big difference, these electrons now can make reflections at the edges and actually move forward. And so these guys, this mode is a transporting mode. And what you can show now, and this was shown by Tules and co-workers very early on, is that actually this band structure of this system here is topologically distinct, and then really in a topology kind of fashion from this material here, and it leads to a new type of insulator where you here have the bulk states, but there's these edge channels which actually cross the gap of your insulator. And of course, if you now have your Fermi level somewhere in the gap, you here will have a point where you can make any finite energy excitation you want, so this state is metallic. And so this is a material with an insulating bulk and a metallic edge. Now, this is a very nice system and a completely new state of matter. But of course, once you see this deviant behavior of an insulator, you start wondering whether there's other classes of different insulators. And people have been looking at this for quite a long time, something like 20 years, until Charlie Kane and Eugene Mallet came with a couple of papers. Actually, these are the first papers already did in 2005, where they showed that you could create, by spin orbit coupling, a similar situation where you have, again, a different topology from here and from here. If you have a very specific band structure, in their case, it does not really involve inversion. Well, it does, but it's a really special type of spin-orbit coupling that they suggested in graphene that should do it. And this spin-orbit coupling leads to edge channels at the edges of your sample at zero magnetic field. And these edge channels are spin polarized because they're locked to the direction of movement of the carriers. So now you would have not one, but two types of edge channels crossing the gap. And so this was predicted in graphene with a very special kind of spin-orbit coupling. And at the time that appeared, it was not really generally understood that this would apply to, say, inverted Dirac systems. And this is actually what Su Cheng told me. So how can you look at it in a very simplified picture for people who know the quantum Hall effect? Well, you may remember this Haldane picture of the quantum Hall effect, where you take a cross-section to your material. This is your conduction band, this is your valence band. And now at the edges of the sample, you have to do something with the potential. Because otherwise, if I have electrons in my conduction band, if the potential that they see doesn't bend up, they would leave the sample. So this is, well, the ionization potential or the work function, whatever you call it. So the energy levels that the electrons see go up. The same thing for Hall states. The energy level for the Halls here have to bend down to contain the Halls. So this is a boring normal insulator. And if you're just a Fermi energy in the gap, you don't see any conductance. Now, if I have an inverted system, the situation is different. Because now I have a conduction band which at the edge of the sample remembers it's a Hall state and it will bend downwards. And the same thing in reverse is true for the valence band which remembers it's a conduction band. And this happens at the point where the topology changes. So the topology inside my material is different from that in vacuum. And in vacuum I have the topology basically that a conduction band is a conduction band. What you get now, if you adjust the Fermi energy in the middle of the gap in the bulk of the material, is that it will cross these dispersions at the edge of the sample, meaning I have a metallic state again of the edge of my sample. And if you now know that these surface states are Dirac states, where you have spin locking of the direction of your spin to the direction of your K state, you can understand that actually you now have spin polarized edge channels going along the sides of your sample. So this is a very simple model, but it's not so wrong. This is what a topological insulator is. Show this behavior, the first experiment you can do is simply measure the conductance of a material when you scan the Fermi level through the gap. If it's a normal insulator, of course, the conductance should go to zero. If it's a topological insulator, well, you have these edge channels here going along the edges of your sample. And if you bias here and you ground here, you have one channel for spin up going from left to right and one for spin down going from left to right, meaning that in total, you have two one-dimensional S channels, and the conductance should be quantized at 2E squared over H. So that's the experiment we did. And these first samples, we could not really scan all the way into the valence band. A bit later we could. But you see that samples where we have inverted band structure all have a conductance somewhere close to 2E squared over H when the Fermi level is in the gap. And a control sample has very high resistance when I'm at that point here. So this is a marked difference. And this was the first observation of the conductance quantization due to quantum spin-Hall effect. This is a few weeks later. All of a sudden, we had samples that we could scan into the peer regime. And you see we have still the same type of quantization, which is not perfect, but it's there. And it's a very clear difference between the normal band structure and the inverted samples. I should say the quantization is not perfect because there's one thing the quantum Hall effect has that we don't have. The quantum Hall effect has left movers and right movers separated by the width of the sample. So these states don't overlap. In our case, they are on top of each other. And in principle, they cannot talk to each other because this is forbidden by symmetry, the Kammer's duplet. But what you will have in the narrow gap semiconductors is that there will be regions of metallic puddles in your material where these S channels will simply impinge on them. And they don't go around them like the quantum Hall S channels. And if you have a little metallic droplet, you can have spin relaxation and you can have backscattering. And that's what's causing all these problems. And this very likely has to do with the gate that we have to put on. But yeah, we cannot do without a gate. Okay, to show that we really have S channels and not something like ballistic transport, we apply the lessons we learned in the 80s and 90s. We go for non-local transport and do things where you would not see a non-local signal unless you have S channels. And so we have these two types of samples. This one we call an H bar, this is a double H. We can make them a bit bigger now. We think that the, so if we make our samples too big, we don't see the quantization. And that probably has to do with the inelastic scattering length along the edges of the sample. And again, this is playing with lithography. Now, you can easily work out what you would expect in terms of non-local signals. This is a very simple generalization of Landauer-Wittecker formalism, where you now just take, instead of one, have two edge channels connecting all the different contacts. Well, you have to just count the states, and you can easily work out from this transmission matrix passing current from, say, 1, 2, 4, what will I see between two various voltage contacts. And that works out very nicely. What you see here is one of these H bars where I pass a current from 1 to 4, and I measure a non-local voltage between 2 and 3. This is already a pretty decisive experiment because ballistic transport would not give a non-local signal. If I have a ballistic transport, carriage would just shoot on along this leg and I would not see anything. If I would have diffusive transport, I might have some voltage spreading in here, but you can really squeeze it to a very small level by making this guy narrow enough. And so what you see is a non-local voltage. This is again as a function of gate voltage, and here I hit the band gap. What you see here is that we see this non-local voltage coming up when I start having my S channels. And I also see it's quantized at 4E squared over H, which is exactly what I predicted from Landauer-Wittecker. The two terminal does more or less what it should be doing. So this already is very clear evidence that I have S channels. There's no other way I can see this non-local signal. Now, to show that there are actually these helical S channels from the quantum spin Hall effect, not the chiral ones from the quantum Hall effect, the best way to do is to go to longitudinal resistance measurements, because in the quantum Hall effect, you only have one longitudinal resistance, depending on for any device configuration. Here we really have different longitudinal resistances depending on how we measure it. And to show what's going on, this is a spider-like structure where we pass a current from 1 to 4 and measure voltage between 2 and 3. This is actually how we measured the original Coulter spin hall data. And again, here we see a conductance of 2E squared over H in a non-local measurement and a two-terminal resistance that's three times as large. However, what you can do now is you pass a current from 1 to 3 and measure a voltage between 5 and 6. And now I have this extra contact 4 here. Normally, in the quantum Hall effect, this guy would not matter at all, because I pass my bias from here to here. S channels go downstream. That means this guy is downstream from my bias, and these contacts are not influenced by this guy being present or not. But because I now have my helical S channels, I have the other spin state, which actually couples 4 and 5 and 5 and 6 stream upwards. And because of that, I see now a different longitudinal resistance, which in this case is 3E squared over H, and a different two-terminal, which has 4 times more resistance now. So this really shows that these hedge channels are helical and not chiral. And then what you want to demonstrate is that they're spin polarized, these hedge channels. And for that, actually, we resorted to an all-electrical measurement. The reason being that the magnetic signal from these spins in the hedge channels is way too small to measure in a different way. And what we use is the metallic intrinsic spin Hall effect. Is this something that people know about? Should I explain a little bit? It's an effect. We started working on all of this. Because spin orbit terms became important in spintronics about 10 years ago or so. And one of the things that people were getting interested in was something called the spin Hall effect. And this is the reason that these two-dimensional TIs were called quantum spin Hall effect. But this is a very different effect, actually. The effect is simply that if you have a device like this, this was our first H-bar, and you pass a current through this leg here, if you have no spin orbit coupling, this is all fine, and this leg will not see anything. However, if you have spin orbit coupling, the k states that you try to excite here are not eigenstates of the system. The eigenstates are j states because you have spin orbit coupling. And because of that, if you force a current going through a leg of spin orbit coupled metal, the metal has to conserve angular momentum, and it will do so by developing a pure spin current perpendicular to your electrical current. That's the spin Hall effect. And for a long time, it was very, very difficult to measure the spin Hall effect. And this is a suggestion that actually we made 10 years ago to measure the effect. But at the time, we couldn't really measure it. And what you could do is make a structure like this. It's an H-bar. And now you have your pure spin current going perpendicular direction. And again, this is a very small signal, so you cannot really measure it. But what you can do is build a wall here, because if the spin current impinges on a wall, again, the system will have to conserve angular momentum, and it will do so by building up a voltage across this leg. This is called the inverse spin Hall effect now. And basically, we suggested here, we couldn't see anything in our experiments. And the reason is, that actually the if the samples are too big, and at that time we had pretty big samples, we couldn't do nanolithography. If the samples are too big, you have more or less diffusive transport, and you can show that if there's a vertex correction to the transport in these spin Hall systems, the whole effect goes away. That was the next paper after this one, but in the course of these S-channel measurements, we started making very small Hall bars. And now we could do e-beam lithography, and we could make our systems ballistic. And then you don't have problems anymore with this vertex correction. And now, for very narrow H-bars, the experiments look very different from the one I showed you, which was about a micro-wide bar. And the reason is that if your legs are very narrow, these edge channels overlap, because they are of the order of 200, 300 nanometers wide in these two-dimensional samples. And if they overlap, they hybridize, and transport is no longer possible. And that's what you see here. There's no non-local signal in the middle of the gap, or hardly any. But what we did see is actually when the sample goes strongly p-type into the valence band, we saw a non-local signal coming up. And this, we believe, is this effect that we predicted in this 2004 theory paper. The effect that you expect to see, the signal you expect to see, is quadratic in spin orbit. First, you have to create a spin current, and then the inverse spin Hall effect. So it's quadratic in your spin orbit. And the spin orbit of the whole system in these materials is an order of magnitude stronger than that in the actual system. So you can expect this asymmetry simply from the stronger spin orbit in the material. But that gave us apart from showing that we have the spin Hall effect detected now, all of a sudden everybody can do it, especially now that we have platinum and tantalum and whatever. This gave us an idea to really measure the spin polarization in our S-channels. And what you can do now is you build another H-bar, but you make a split gate on top. So now I have one part which I can make metallic, and another part which I can gate to be insulating, where I have my quantum spin Hall effect. And you can play nice tricks like here. So here I have my metallic lag. So I pass a current through. So this leads to a spin current, meaning spin accumulation of either side on either side of the bar. And again, normally this is a very small accumulation. It's very difficult to see. But what I can do now is I couple two of these with my edge channels. And these are spin selective. And because of that, I can directly translate the spin accumulation I have on this edge into an electrical signal between 3 and 8. And this is what correlated guys call the magnetoelectric effect, and it's a very, very strong one. I don't know why they have all these oxidic crystals. This is way bigger. So what you see here is this signal, this non-local signal between 3 and 8, as a function of gate voltage on this lag here. So when this lag goes insulating, you see a non-local signal. And the amplitude is exactly, within a factor of 2 of what you calculated in a type binding calculation for 100% polarization of these spin channels. You can do the inverse effect, where you do spin injection, basically. So you take an S-channel, which is spin polarized, you impinge it on a metallic region. Now you also have a spin current attached with that flowing into this region. It sees a wall. And so this region will have to develop an inverse spin Hall effect. And you see, indeed, there's a signal coming in this region when this guy goes insulating, building S-channels. And again, the amplitude is more or less the same. So we did tight binding modeling of this behavior. And, of course, there's all kinds of estimates that you have to make, but we really think that the S-channels are really fully spin polarized. So there is some scanning probe work ongoing. Can show you a little bit of it. I should add a reference. It appeared 2 months ago in Nature Materials. This is work by Cam Moller's group, by Katja Novak, in Stanford. We still have this collaboration with Stanford ongoing, and also with the experimentalist. Cam Moller has a scanning squid. So this is not very high resolution, but she has this little squid that she can scan over devices, and she can measure local magnetic fields that way. And of course, when you have a hole bar where there's a current flowing through, this current will, of course, induce a Lorentz field, and she can pick it up. And of course, from the magnetic field that she measures, she can reconstruct the current flow. And what she has done is she takes a hole bar with a gate on top, so you can scan through the gap. And of course, the quantization is not perfect, but you see the conductance is also not very bad here. So she can compare the current flow in the hole bar in the metallic region and in the region where we have edge channels. And she really sees that. and so here we are in the metallic region. And basically, this is the magnetic field that she sees. Red and blue are opposite directions of magnetic field. So this is basically the Lorentz field just going around your current. And from this, she has to do some modeling, and she can calculate then the current distribution in the bar. And you see it's more or less homogeneous. She has to use these contacts for passing the current, and that's why it's injected at these corners here. Now, if she goes to the insulating regime, you see a very different behavior of the magnetic field around the whole bar, and you see the current is now really going only along the edges. There's even something coming here, even though they're not really directly contacted. So you can really show that you have S-channel transport in this way. That's the nice thing of this experiment. Now, what I had hoped her to be able to show was the magnetization, but no way she can do that. This signal is the Ørsted field, sorry, is way bigger than the signal of the magnetization of the carriers. Well, there's some other work by Ziyech Shen, who has a scanning microwave SNOM. You can use microwave reflectivity to locally sense a metallic region. And that's basically what he can do here. Now, he cannot look through a gate, so you have to use backgating, which is cumbersome, so you can hardly scan your material to the gap. But what he can do is he sees, when you're in the gap, he sees conductance or metallic regions at the edges. And when you start getting into the bands, you see that the whole sample starts to conduct. Okay, this I won't show you, because otherwise I lose my time again. Let's continue now with 3D material. So far, I just talked about two-dimensional topological insulators. And at that time, they were not yet called two-dimensional topological insulators. They were called quantum spin-Hall devices. But you can imagine, once you have this system where you have a quantum Hall effect at zero magnetic field, which is a two-dimensional system, it's pretty insightful that you can generalize this to higher dimensions. And the quantum Hall effect, I have my system in two dimensions, I need to have my magnetic field in the third, and that means that basically I have covered all of real-life physics. Of course, there are generalizations in higher dimensions that you can do these things, but for an experimentalist, they're not so interesting. But if you have a material now where you have an effect at the edge of a two-dimensional quantum well, which gives you a one-dimensional metal, it's not so difficult to think that you can generalize this to having a system with a similar band structure in three dimensions, which has exactly the same effect at the surfaces, giving you two-dimensional surface states. And this is what a topological insulator is. So about a year after our transport experiments, people started showing ARPAS data on bismuth compounds that showed Dirac dispersion on the surface. And these are bulk materials with the Dirac dispersion on the surface. And this was then dubbed topological insulators. And now they're called three-dimensional topological insulators. These bismuth compounds are very easy to fabricate. However, their transport qualities are horrible, which is why we're still working with Merck Telluride. And when we decided we wanted to look at the physics of three-dimensional topological insulators, of course, we tried to do the same thing in Merck Telluride. But I already told you, bulk mercury telluride is a semi-metal. Yeah. At the same time, you have the inversion there. So these surface states, you could call them Pankratov state because he first predicted them in 86. And again, they show up in every decent KDLP calculation. They're everywhere. But nobody realized that they were something topologically special. So you have the surface state. This is a DFT calculation. This is not a DFT calculation. But this is an actual experiment. This is a layer. We grew a very thick layer of Merck telluride, so where you're back at the original mercury telluride lattice constant, and you see the surface state. So it's there. But for us, this still is not good enough because this is a semi-metal. Then we had a tsunami coming in Japan. And it happens to be that the sole supplier of our cadmium zinc telluride substrates is Nikko, and they have a plant very close to Sendai. So they were first forced to close for a while, and we could not get our lattice mat substrate anymore, and started to grow on cadmium telluride, which has a lattice constant which is 0.4% larger than that of mercury telluride. So what you do when you start working with new material is that, well, you grow an epi layer, a test layer, and you stick it in your X-ray machine. And what we saw was this line here. This is thickness fringes from our epi layer, and this is a reflex of the substrate. But it means that actually our epi layer is coherently grown on the substrate. By coherent, I mean that actually it is strained. It has the in-plane lattice constant of the substrate, and the vertical one has to go down. So this is this lowering of symmetry you need to open up a gap. And that's what you see here. This is the states. The black lines are the states we calculate, well, as kind of confinement states. 70 nanometer is somewhere in between a quantum well and bulk. So there's many levels here, but you see there's a gap opening up. This is the surface state that you get for your material. Now, it's kind of an open question whether this surface state is really independent of the bulk or hybridizes with it. It's not really.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is this like a final resonance on the surface?
It's no.
Is it a surface state which has the same energy of the.
Yes. So the surface state is a Dirac state. And you know more or less, we know from other experiments what the density is that we get in a surface state, and to get it correct, you know that the Dirac points must be here. But I'll talk a bit more about it later on. And now for the description, the exact description of the dispersion of your surface state, you have to know whether it hybridizes coherently with all the band states or not. If it doesn't hybridize, this would be the dispersion. It's the Dirac dispersion is linear. If it does hybridize, well, you get something like states like these blue lines here. And so a bit later on, I will try to argue that it will not hybridize. But anyway, whatever it does, you have a clear gap opening, and you should be able to tune your Fermi level into the gap. And you see the signal from the surface states only. And actually, we took that same test wafer and made a hole bar out of it. And what we saw was a very nice quantum Hall effect. And you may know that these bismuth compounds show very tiny wiggles that can be anything. And it's very difficult to really claim that what you see in transport there is the surface state. What you see here is a quantum Hall effect. I can only see a quantum Hall effect from a two-dimensional electron system. And the only ones that I can think of here are the top and bottom surface of my slab. The mobility here is 35,000. And you can fit this pretty nicely using Dirac dispersions for the top and bottom surface state with slightly different densities. And again, that's also very normal. This is a semiconductor, so you will have band bending. It was actually shown in this graph here. You will have band bending across the sample, which gives you a different density on top and bottom surface. So that's very nice. We see the surface state, and there's hardly any contribution from the bulk. I don't think there's any. I think this is all the side walls of my mesa.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Isn't the three-dimensional topology insulator relies on time reversal symmetry?
It's the same as the two-dimensional one. Only your backscattering rules are a bit lifted. So there's a backscattering rule against 180 degrees backscattering, but of course the other angles are still allowed. So in that sense, they're kind of a bit weaker than a two-dimensional topological insulator. But for the rest, it's the same type of thing. Yeah. So I mean, of course, when you apply this magnetic field, you do away with all this reversal protection. But I need to do it. Because my quantum Hall effect gives me something like a spectroscopy to show that I have Dirac states. Yeah? But so they help for the mobility. That's the idea. And the mobility is go ahead. It was 30,000 here, but it's getting a lot better now. Okay. So to take this further, you can do many things. One thing we did is we take a. So what you should wonder now is this is a undoped test sample, and somehow I see a response from this sample as if we see the sulfur surface states only. So would it be that my Fermi level is just by chance in the gap? It's not by chance. That's what I try to argue now. So I take a sample with a gate. I have this sample which has a surface state through which I do transport. Now I oxidize the whole surface. I put my gate oxide on, and I put a gate on top. And the surface state is still there. Basically, what it does, it digs into your material, and it sits there where crystallinity ends. So it doesn't care, there's some oxide there. What you see now is a quantum Hall effect for a whole series of gate voltages. And it's always there. And for minus one gate voltage, what you see is quantum Hall plateaus at 1, 3, 5, 7. So at minus one gate voltage, I have flat band, meaning that I have equal density in both top and bottom surface. And I see clearly the Dirac sequence of these plateaus. There are some other observations you can make. Let's look at this one, for example. It's clearest here. So this is 1, 3, 5, 7. Here at 1/2 volt, I start seeing some intermediate plateaus simply because, well, the densities are not equal anymore. But what I also see in the Shubnikov de Haas is it is as if they're built up of two different sequences. One which is narrow, another peak which is broad. And here's a peak that is narrow and a peak that's broad. It's even more broadened here at 0 volt. So what it looks like is that my top and bottom surface state have a different mobility. They act as if they're different metals. Well, that's understandable. They're pretty far apart. But it's different from all the modeling we usually do. Because basically, these KDP calculations, if you have everything hybridizing with everything, then you assume coherent transport. Now, this is a question you can wonder about these samples. Now, another analysis, what we plot here as the circles here are simply the points in this colored graph where the quantum Hall traces and all these gate voltages change plateau. So this is the gate voltage and this is the field where this happens. And so just by eye, you can analyze this as follows. I have actually two completely independent Landau fans. They don't seem to do anything to each other. So again, what I apparently see is top and bottom surface, which have a different gate influence, which of course you expect because the top surface will screen the gate somewhat. In my response here, I also see an absence of spin splitting, but again, it's something which points to the surface states, because the big thing about these surface states is that they are each other's spin conjugate. So you don't have a spin splitting of a single in a single surface. So again, this is pointing to the fact that I have my single surface states. The weird thing is that this happens for all gate voltages. This is an enormous range. And this should be more than enough to really scan my Fermi level way into the bulk that I would expect hybridization and not see this Dirac behavior anymore. And again here, if I go and look at the quantization of the Hall plateaus, it's pretty good, it's not perfect, it's pretty good, but it's independent of gate voltage. That means that I do not add a bulk contribution to my transport. And again, for all these gate voltages, if I look for this Berry phase, which you have for Dirac fermions, they all show this Berry phase. They all act if they have a Dirac dispersion. And the only thing we can conclude from this now is that actually what's happening is that these surface states are very high mobility, and they're kind of, because of that, they are kind of electrostatically decoupled from the bulk. And all carriers that you may create in the bulk simply move through the surface, and the bulk, well, they act as a Faraday cage which is surrounding your bulk and basically screen it off. And that means you can do some artificial modeling of this, basically turn off the hybridization. That means that if you change your gate voltage, say like here between minus one and zero volt, the only thing that happens, your Fermi level is somehow always in the gap because the system chooses to be it because of the screening. And if you change your gate voltage, the only thing that happens is that you push your Dirac points apart. you push them away. But for any gate voltage, I will have a Fermi level in the gap because it's a Faraday cage, and I see my transport only to the surface state. So that's the newer observation. Now, again, my time is already running out. 5 minutes or?
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Yep. Very briefly then. Now, the good thing is that we know that whatever gate voltage we apply, we have transport to the surface state. And what you want to do now, of course, is try to do proximity effects in the surface states, because that's where all the fun is. The surface states should show, well, like action, electromagnetism and things like that. And they might show Majorana modes if you do superconductivity. So you want to contact these surface states now with ferromagnets, which I won't show too much about, and also with superconductors. I can show you a bit about the superconductors. Let me just go to the thing that really worked. And so what we have here, again, is our usual straight mercury telluride. And what we contacted with is niobium. And the hope is to induce a supercurrent which goes then through this surface state here. What you see here as a function of bias is indeed that we can create a supercurrent. In this IV curve, you see also the resistance is going down towards lower bias, which means that I have a pretty transparent contact. There are some things we don't understand. Perhaps there's somebody here who does understand. There's these wiggles, which we see in the IV curve, which seem to reproduce. This could be a remnant of the AC Josephson effect. We don't really know what it is, but it's pretty reproducible. There are some people who hope that this might be some Krost-Andreev. I don't really know. But we're talking with some specialists about what this could be. It could just be, well, something electronic. But the good thing is that we really have a supercurrent. Here's scanning the current and not the voltage. We have a nice and robust supercurrent going through our surface state at various temperatures. We see a hysteresis, which for me is also an indication that I'm not shunted by bulk states. And we have a pretty good ICRM product of something like 200 microvolts. So we really have a nice Josephson junction on this two-dimensional surface state. And this is a bit the problem. Can you see Majoranas in a two-dimensional surface state? Those of you who may follow the field may know that there were first predictions by Fu and Kane that indeed you should get a Majorana. But what Fu and Kane did not realize is that you get a Majorana and you get 10 to the 5 non-Majorana modes. And, well, one of the things where you could see whether you have Majorana effects is go to the Fraunhofer pattern that you have if you take your the supercurrent in your device and you plot it against applied magnetic field. Now, what you see, and there were some people showing very weird Fraunhofer patterns, what you see is that our Fraunhofer pattern is very, very regular. What we really think is that any irregularities simply come from somewhat inhomogeneous current distribution in the sample. Actually, what the Fraunhofer pattern is nothing else than a Fourier transform of the current distribution in your sample. And so if you don't have a homogeneous contact over all your couple of microns that these contacts are long, then you easily get these deviations, and they vary from sample to sample. So for now, we think that, yeah, we have a nice supercurrent in these samples. I don't think we have any evidence from this measurement that we see Majorana modes. The next steps indicated here we've already done. We have squids, and we hope that we see some phase shift in the IFI curves, but that's still to be debated. We also have first results now on supercurrent in two-dimensional samples. Still no true evidence for the existence of Majoranas, but this is coming along nicely. And for me, the big surprise is that actually we struggled for years making supercontacts on semiconductors, and it never worked. And in this material, it's pretty easy. And the reason it's so easy, I think, is that the Schottky are leaky. So we simply go through them. So yeah, we're not there yet, but I consider this actually very promising results. Towards a supercurrent, I think in half a year or a year, we should really know whether there's any Majoranas or not. Okay, that's the whole story I wanted to tell you. This is the work that my group is really doing. We have actually one guy still working on thermoelectrics, just for the fun of it. Theory is important, and these guys always want their name mentioned. So let me do that. Thank you for your attention.